and welcome to episode 66 of the DFA podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grossnick, and joining me, we have a special episode and a special guest today. Joining me is Craig Goldstein, the minor league editor for Baseball Prospectus. Craig, thank you so much for making the time to talk to us about some big deals that have happened.
I'm always happy to talk trades and prospects.
Yeah, well, we've got plenty of both to talk about. Two major trades. One of which went down actually yesterday, although it had been rumored for some time. The Orioles finally dealing Manny Machado. He's going to the Dodgers. And then just a couple of hours ago, I guess, the Indians made a blockbuster trade of their own, sending Francisco Mejia to the Padres for Adam Simber and Brad Hand, two pretty interesting relief pitchers. I think it would be fun to kick things off with the Machado trade because that's really kind of in your wheelhouse. It's both prospects and Dodgers related. And, you know, I know the Dodgers are your second favorite team, but I know you follow them pretty closely. So
don't you get in on that too.
it's too easy not to not to bring up. But I think it's really fun to talk about this deal, and especially with you with your depth of knowledge. So how do you feel about this Machado deal? Just gut reaction.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty fair trade. I honestly was expecting maybe something a little bit more concentrated in terms of talent, maybe a better second piece and a flyer, or kind of not really a big deal on the third piece. But as opposed to five guys going from the Dodgers system over. But really, in either of those situations, the focus should be on Yusniel Diaz, who I fortunately just saw at the Futures game on Sunday.
Nice.
He hit two home runs in that game. He put on a really nice BP. It was funny. I tweeted this during the game, and I said, you know, he's not going to put on a batting practice that's going to really like be a show for anyone. It's not Peter Alonso in terms of raw power, or even, you know, Taylor Trammell was hitting him in the second deck. Leody Taveras was hitting him in the second deck. Diaz isn't that type of guy, but he definitely has gotten stronger. Multiple people have noted he's added about 10 to 15 pounds of muscle this year. He's been healthy this year, and he's someone who in batting practice, you saw the carry off the bat. Like, it made a good sound and it carried off the bat. The ball tended to go further than you would have thought on initial trajectory. So there's definitely some latent power in there. And then during the game, you know, when you get 96 at the letters, if you're a good hitter, you can put that out. So, he's really interesting. I don't think he's a center fielder. I think, you know, he plays there a little bit, but he's probably a right fielder. I know our scouting reports, we've had plenty of people who've seen him. Kevin Carter in Double A this year, Wilson Kerrigan in High A last year, saw him a ton. And he's someone who has taken a little bit of time to adjust to the Double A level, but has been really good there this year. I know in the field, his arm, when I saw him in the Futures game, he was in left, and he uncorked a throw that was honestly below average. It wasn't even really an average arm, but the reports have been closer to average, or maybe a touch above. So it might've just been, you know, one weird throw. It's a small sample, but the bat is what you're there for. I mean, he'll be a competent corner outfielder, and he's going to hit for average. I don't think he's going to hit for a ton of power, despite me talking about it like that. It's probably more, you know, 20 to 25 in this day and age, but that's plenty.
Yeah, that certainly is. I was kind of surprised that he was the centerpiece of this deal for the Orioles, not in that his talent level, but I figured the Orioles might be interested in a different type of player than Diaz. Maybe they would be interested in pitching because obviously they can't develop their own. They'd be more interested in some of the guys who ranked a little bit higher on our midseason 50 list at Baseball Prospectus. Somebody like, I know that BP is a little bit higher on Keibert Ruiz than most people, but maybe Alex Verdugo. And I was also kind of surprised, like you were, that the deal wasn't a little more concentrated, that you didn't see somebody like May as a secondary piece to this. So I was kind of surprised at that, though. I guess Diaz did have a heck of a showing in the short term. So I guess maybe the Orioles, I doubt they were really, you know, turned one way or the other by his Futures game run. But, you know, this just seemed like it was kind of a strange package to me, with them going after another corner outfielder who can hit. But I guess he was probably the talent that they wanted the most out of the guys who were available in the Dodgers system.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things where they're not exactly opposed to playing limited. Adam Jones was obviously a tremendous outfielder at one point. He's declined since then. If you want to live with Diaz in center, I think you can. It's just not going to be major league average in all likelihood.
Right.
I think it's an interesting package because, you know, as you're talking, I think May would have been the big name, and that was obviously floated a little bit. But when you talk about a guy like Ryland Bannon, who we got notes from the field on from Wilson Caraman this year, he saw him at Rancho Cucamonga, which is a great place to hit. Even within the Cal League, it's a very good place to hit, and he's doing very well there. But there's some legitimate tools for Bannon. And when you look at the arms, Dean Kramer, I think I tweeted this last night, so I'm going off the top of my head, but 114 strikeouts in 79 innings,
right?
At high A, again, at high A, which is a very good place to hit. He's performed very well there. Zach Pop, mid-90s, really a lot of movement on his pitches. Ground ball guy, almost definitely a reliever. I don't think there's a ton of upside in Pop, but when you talk about Kramer and Bannon, those are the kind of like mid-level guys in the org that have the ability. Look, if Bannon's the real deal outside of the California League, that's going to look like a steal, honestly. Yeah. And if Kramer can stay in the rotation, that's a really nice get. And all of a sudden you're talking about Diaz might not have the upside that we'd associate with a guy traded for Manny Machado, but these other guys have the ability to, if you think Diaz is an average regular or maybe an above average regular, which is within the realm of possibility, and then you get a fourth starter and even if it's a second division regular in Bannon, plus a reliever in Pop, like that's a really good haul for 2 months of Manny Machado. And I'm not someone who likes to downplay the rental aspect of stuff like this and say, look, it's Manny freaking Machado.
Right.
I think that's this, but that's why I said it's a fair deal. There's risk and reward for the Orioles, but there's also safety. I mean, they went safety on the top guy and then kind of fleshed out the deal with some guys that have some upside. Now there's also downside in those guys. If Bannon isn't the real deal, he's probably an org player, then they might have gotten two relievers out of it.
Right.
Is that worth it for Manny Machado? I think it's probably still worth it for 2 months for the Orioles. They seem to not be getting a ton of traction early on. You know, I don't know if Cleveland was offering someone like, you know, they obviously could have put Ramirez at second base and Machado at third if he was willing to do it. And if someone like Mejia was on the table, we'll get to him later. But, you know, I don't know what the other offers are, but on a pure value standpoint for 2.5 months of Machado, it's not a bad get. I think it's really pretty even.
No, I do think that it's kind of interesting that the Orioles, if you're going to do one of these more quantity heavy trades with, you know, a 5-for-1 type of deal, and they're all going to be prospects, there are much worse teams that you could try to draw out those secondary and tertiary pieces from than the Dodgers system. I mean, if I were going to be trading somebody and looking for those secondary pieces, the Dodgers system is deep enough to be able to get some interesting guys and get guys who have some real helium, I think, at some point. I really think Bannon's interesting. I read Wilson's write-up on him, and I watched that little bit of video, and he looks pretty fun if he's one of those guys that could work out for them. He definitely seems like a guy who could kind of come up in the mold of, like, Brian Anderson, maybe, for the Marlins or somebody like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's the thing. If that's your second guy and he works out like that, again, for the tail end of a season from even if it is Manny Machado, that's useful, especially for the Orioles, who lack a lot of depth in their system. They don't have these depth pieces.
And the other interesting thing, I think, is that, you know, when you talk about what the returns would be, it's a very tough match to find a team that would be willing to take the rental on Machado, but also has the combination of depth and top-end talent to acquire a player like Machado. Like, I really think the only other team that had a good crack at this was probably the Brewers, because I don't know if the Phillies, I mean, I know a lot about the Phillies system because I listen to the BP Mets podcast, as weird as that sounds. But I mean, it's one of those things where, yeah, the Phillies could have been in it. The Brewers could have been in it. The Dodgers could have been in it. But it seems like it may have just been a three-team look at that, because how many of those teams really are willing to make the rental agreement on Machado and give up the talent at the same time? You know, the yeah. Brewers and the Phillies still look like teams that are trying to build out their contention window. The Dodgers are just in that position where they proved last year it doesn't matter. They'll rent a guy like Yu Darvish and let him go at the end of the season and be okay with that because they're the freaking Dodgers.
Right. Right. And I mean, again, it is kind of where the stars have aligned, because Seager has obviously been out the whole year and the Dodgers are now doing okay without him, entering the All-Star break in first place. But they're going to want Seager back at shortstop. Right. And it makes sense for them to get Machado because he's done at the end of the year and provides a clean, you know, it's an impact bat. I don't think the glove is as bad as the metrics say, although, you know, FRAA is not as down as some of the other metrics.
Right.
And it allows him to walk away and Seager to step right back into his role as a budding superstar. So I think, you know, along those narrative lines, it makes tons of sense.
Yeah, and I kind of explored in the TA that I have up at Baseball Prospectus what kind of position the Dodgers could be in to make an effort to re-sign Machado. I mean, it's an open question whether or not he would want to go there, what his eventual contract's going to be come this offseason. It's going to change things dramatically if the Dodgers run roughshod in the playoffs and win their first championship. I think that might affect things a little bit. But I could see a world where the Dodgers make a good effort, a good faith effort to retain Machado and then kind of play around with the rest of their roster in order to kind of make some room. It would probably involve doing something with Justin Turner, whether it would be moving him to first base or something like that. Yeah. The Dodgers just have so many moving parts that you could see a world where they would keep Machado, but you could also see, just like you said, just swap him out for Seager for next year and you go back and you run it back pretty much the same way they would have this year with a slightly different elite shortstop.
Yeah, and probably, I mean, look, there's a lot of moving pieces, as you said, and not just on the field. There's trying to stay under the luxury tax so that they can really spend in the offseason, whether that's going to be on Machado or other pitchers or Bryce Harper or, you know, whoever else is out there. I think Machado is obviously tantalizing because, especially if he's willing to stick at third. You have Seager at short and Machado at third. Seager's not a premium defensive asset by any means, but you move Turner to first. God only knows what you do with Max Muncy. I don't know. But they would have to resolve a lot of things in their outfield because that would push Bellinger to the outfield. They already have Jock Peterson. They have Yasiel Puig through the end of next year. They have Enrique Hernandez, who plays all over. They have Andrew Tolles. As you said, they have Verdugo.
Yeah.
We can list all these guys, but this goes back to the point that, and they have Chris Taylor, by the way. And this just reinforces the point that the reason that the Orioles are able to pry a guy like Diaz off the Dodgers, and to be clear, Diaz is one of the top prospects in the Orioles system. I think we had him behind Ryan Mountcastle in our midseason list, but Jeff and I have both already agreed that we probably had Mountcastle a little too high. There's an argument that Diaz is the top prospect in the Orioles system already. And the reason that that's, you know, able to happen is because the Dodgers have such a logjam at the top levels right now. And arguably that's a reason to go get a guy like Verdugo instead of Diaz, but there's not as much of a gap between those two names as people or an ordinal ranking list might imply. The likely outcomes are not dramatically different. I think Verdugo has a little more upside, which is why we put him where he is. He's an incredible natural hitter, but they're both probably corner outfielders, and there's a decent chance Diaz ends up with more power than Verdugo does.
Yeah, I think it just makes it really interesting, and I do think it kind of puts into relief that the Dodgers are probably overloaded with hitters anyway for 2019, even if you don't factor in Machado. They've got Kemp under contract. They can move him.
Kemp, right? I didn't even mention Kemp.
Right, who's like the cleanup hitter for this team. I mean, it's wild. I think it's going to be really interesting to see what they do in the offseason anyways. I definitely think they're going to do something to try to convert some of their positional talent into pitching talent, which they've done several times in the past at some point. But yeah, as much as I would love to see Machado stick in LA, it doesn't feel like it's the Friedman and Zaidi move to go sign him now to a $250 million contract or something like that.
It does not feel that way, but they do a lot of things. You know, people try and put them in a box, and they really do act. I don't think that there's a strong way to. I would not have predicted that they got Machado. I understand right. that there's a clean thing for Machado stepping in at short, but the reality of the situation is that Taylor was doing pretty well at short.
Yep.
And the roster rejiggering that we had to do, and you know, I'm trying to help out with our depth charts, you know. And I'm trying to figure out, okay, who's getting how much time where? And it's hard to figure out because you've got Muncy, who, you know, Taylor will now be at second, but they also said he's going to play center field and maybe some corner outfielder. Bellinger's going to be in center and maybe corner and also first base. Machado's going to be at shortstop, but also play some third base and give Turner a rest. Turner's probably at third and first. Muncy's at first some now. There's a lot of moving parts for a real cost, which was why I didn't think they would do this, honestly. You know, obviously Diaz is a good asset to have, and I think he's a piece that it's you want to use to improve your major league team. That's fine. I would have thought it would have come for relief or starting pitching more than Machado. That's basically why I didn't think it was going to happen, because it's a lot of moving pieces. And look, again, it is Manny freaking Machado, so I'm not complaining. It's just I would have thought they already have a pretty good lineup. I mean, I tweeted this. They have 10 players. They're going to have 10 players with 180-plus plate appearances that are above league average per OPS plus.
That's astonishing. That is just... Right. So,
and that's with Machado. But again, they had over a full lineup when you count the pitcher spot every night with that as the case. So this wasn't the most dire need. You know what I mean?
No. But I as usual, I applaud the Dodgers for going for it, because absolutely. It's been a lot of time getting to the playoffs and falling short, and I definitely am all in for teams really trying to make that extra push to do whatever they can to beat up on teams in the postseason. And, you know, one of these things is they got out-pitched for sure against the Astros, and yeah. I don't know what, you know, the Astros had this thing where they were able to throw all these great pitchers consistently at the Dodgers' very impressive lineup. They're going to have an even tougher time of things opposing pitchers against this lineup in the playoffs this year. So, you know, good luck to whoever is stuck facing this lineup on the regular. And good luck to you, Logan Forsyth, because I would be 100.
He's getting traded. I'm
yeah,
sure.
He's not going to be on this team in August, right?
I can't imagine. I unless teams are just refusing to engage because he's A, not that good, and B, owed a little bit of money, and they know the Dodgers need to dump him. But my suspicion is that they'll package some mid-level prospects and Logan Forsyth for some salary relief and maybe a reliever.
Yeah, one of those, you know, quad A arms that's, you know, two pitches and
the Dylan
and
Floro types, right? I mean, like,
well, I mean, if they could get another Dylan Floro, that would shore up the bullpen pretty nicely.
But the cost there was basically minimal. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It was, yeah. So I don't know that they're going to get in on maybe the guys that we're about to talk about, that caliber of guys, but they might get a few more arms that they think we can fix this.
Yeah,
and dump some salary in the process.
I definitely agree with you. So let's jump into to some relief arms. We'll switch gears a little bit. We'll talk about that other trade. So the Padres deal Brad Hand and Adam Simber to the Indians. The Indians had been talked about for a long time as needing bullpen help, which is kind of weird if you've been following the Indians over the last 3 years to think that they would possibly need some bullpen help. But 2018 was a very different animal for this team. Their bullpen's been horrible, mostly because Andrew Miller's been gone. But all those little, kind of waiver wire scrap heap pickups that they've had over the past couple of years, well, that has stopped working as it is prone to do all the time. Meanwhile, the Padres have developed a very nice bullpen and basically nothing else. So Simber and Hand go to the Indians, which is not a crazy unexpected thing. What I feel is unexpected is that the return going back to San Diego is one of the guys who's considered a top 10 prospect in baseball in Francisco Mejia. I think people are probably surprised at the caliber of prospect going the other way when it's just, quote, just two relievers going back to Cleveland. Why did Cleveland make this deal, and why is it more even than it might appear on its face?
Well, I think the years of control, right? And that's one of the big ones. Hand is signed through 2021. I think he just signed an extension, mm-hmm. right, relatively recently with the Padres. And he's been really good. I mean, this is real talent that the Indians are getting. And I think in the same breath that we're talking about seeing teams go for it, I think we can appreciate this with Cleveland, right? Absolutely. They have no competition in that division. They don't need these guys to enter the playoffs and hope the crapshoot that is the playoffs, you know, comes up for them, right? I mean, this is something that they are walking into the playoffs either way this year. I can appreciate them going for it because this is entirely designed around succeeding in the playoffs. You know, we saw them struggle. They had the two-game lead on New York last year, right? And blew that.
Right.
You know, this is, as you said, this Cleveland bullpen is normally nails, but we're seeing Cody Allen has a 4.66 ERA. He's still missing bats, but it's, you know, he's struggling for his standards. He's giving up a lot of home runs. Zach McAllister, normally good, 5.65 ERA. Dan Otero, I mean, most people might laugh and say Dan Otero, that's not a name you need to be bringing up. He's, you know, he's a middle reliever. He's been like sub three ERA for like two straight years at least.
Right.
He's been really good. He's been awful. He's over five. So they are really struggling to replace Andrew Miller. You know, they're getting a hell of a performance in 13 innings from Oliver Perez right now. I think they reasonably said we can't rely on that.
I was really excited to bring up Oliver Perez because
ERA.
Yeah, it's nice. It's a nice ERA. Yeah, he and Brandon Guyer have basically kept the lowest ERAs in this bullpen for the Indians, which is really saying something. When you've got guys who are, you know, you expect to be pretty good, and even Josh Tomlin has done some time in the bullpen. Josh Tomlin has been as bad as anybody could possibly be. You said McAllister, Adam Plutko hasn't done well in the bullpen, and yeah, this is a team with a phenomenal starting pitching, but there's nobody there right now outside of Allen who can hold up, and I guess Perez, which is weird.
Yeah, and the other part of this is they were so overloaded with pitching options in years past that, you know, they could either throw Salazar in the bullpen and he's done for either most of the year or the year, mm-hmm. and you know, like a guy like Mike Clevenger could come in and be a reliever come playoff times, but they're going to need him in the rotation. So it's one of those situations where, you know, guys like Shane Bieber or Adam Plutko aren't going to translate to the bullpen the same way that a guy like Clevenger would have, or right. some of the other names that they've used in the past. And so I don't think they could rely on that boost. And they reasonably looked at their bullpen and said, you know, we need to address this. So they went out and get one of the better lefty relievers. I mean, this is akin to the Miller deal. And it's, look, Brad Hand is not Andrew Miller, but this year he might be better than Andrew Miller because Miller's had health issues. And Adam Simber is a guy a lot of people might not know about because he pitches in the seventh inning of meaningless games on the West Coast, where a lot of people in the middle and East Coast of the country aren't awake to watch it. But he's a really interesting guy. He's a different arm slot. He's a submariner, or, you know, low three quarters guy. One quarter guy kind of thing.
Right.
And he's been really good, and they get 5 years of him. I mean, that's why you trade a guy like Mejia, who, again, we really like and we've liked for a long time. But look, I understand that Mejia got off to a really slow start this year. It was a putrid April. From May through July 13th, he is hitting .320, .372, .490 at AAA. There's nothing wrong with that. He's 22 years old. Like, that's and he's a catcher. That's really good. I'm interested to hear your take on what this means for Austin Hedges.
Well, I think it means for Austin Hedges that they see him as a backup catcher or not a catcher, much of a catcher long term for this team at all anymore. And I'm really disappointed with that, but I kind of understand it. He just has not been the type of overall, you know, superstar kind of catcher that we kind of thought he might be. The defense hasn't exactly been as world-beating as we may have thought it was going to be 5 years ago, and the offense has never come through. I'm really surprised after a couple of years, in 2016, 2017, when he was hitting for more power, that he hasn't been able to display more in the limited time he's played this year. I think the Padres are about ready to consider Hedges backup and the type of backup who can play maybe, you know, 60 to 80 games a year behind Mejia, who may not be a full-time catcher anymore. Mm-hmm. But I think the ship probably has sailed on him, and they love what he can do defensively, but it's no longer this huge gap between the best defensive catchers and the worst defensive catchers. I think the defensive kind of metrics for catchers and the way that we look at framing now has shortened up what our bars are for a really great defensive catcher and a really terrible defensive catcher, because there aren't that many really terrible defensive catchers in the league anymore.
Right. Well, okay. So that gets to my question for you, because I went in and I looked at, you know, BP's framing numbers for him, and I look at FRAA, and last year he was very, you know, extremely good.
Yeah.
He was like over 30 runs above average, right?
Right.
This year he's on pace for like 8.
Yes.
Which is still good. So I guess I was interested to hear, and it seems like you might be hinting that the reason for that is not necessarily a significant decline in his skill, but a raising of what above average means, what the baseline is there. Is that reasonable?
I think that's part of it. And I also don't think he's really, yes, he's on pace for 8 runs of FRAA, a positive 8. And last year he was a positive 30. I think that we've found that the advanced metrics for catching, they fluctuate a lot more year to year, especially recently, than really what the true talent level is for these guys. He's still a true talent, phenomenal defensive catcher. I don't think that's the question at all. But at the same time, this Padres team cannot live with a black hole at any position at this point, because they already have too many of them. And even for a really plus defensive pitcher catcher who can really help your staff, I think they've got to find something else to give more overall value out of the position. And I like Austin Hedges. I think he's a fine option for a rebuilding team as an everyday catcher. But when you have the opportunity to go get Francisco Mejia, who very well in a couple of years could be a top 5 catcher in all of baseball, you weigh the positives against the negatives and you go for the guy who's got the most talent. That's one of the reasons why initially I really liked this deal for the Padres, because Mejia has the ability to be a top-end offensive catcher. And while the bars for how good defensively catchers are kind of shortening a little bit, there are only like 5 good offensive catchers in baseball right now, and Mejia has the ability to join that group.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think what you said about Hedges being a more oft-used backup makes this a really interesting acquisition, because some of the questions on Mejia is, we talk about not a full-time catcher. It's not just his defensive abilities, which I think could overcome. I mean, he's got a really strong arm. I know the footwork and his receiving could probably use a little bit of work. I don't think they're so bad that they'd normally push him off the position. Part of the reason he gets pushed off or was for Cleveland is because he's more athletic than a lot of catchers are,
right,
number one. But number two, and this is should probably be number one, it's probably the more important reason, he's pretty small. As catchers go, he's listed 5'10", 180. They're probably both a little on the heavier, you know, a little weighted towards. He's probably a little shorter than that and a little lighter than that. And the question is he going to hold up as an offensive performer over 100 to 130 games? And the likelihood on guys who don't have extremely sturdy frames, like I said, he's really athletic. But he's on the smaller side. And these were the questions that dogged similarly Blake Swihart, who I think was listed closer to 6'1", but obviously different issues there in terms of throwing. But again, these are the questions that dogged some of these guys, is are they going to hold up over the course of a full season? Because it's an extremely demanding position and the grind is very real. And we see that with a guy like Salvador Perez, who's built exactly like you want a catcher to be built, but still has that offensive fall off every year because just because he plays too many games, right?
Right.
So the question is, you know, what is Mejia's threshold for games before he experiences that drop off? And it's probably lower than guys like Perez or Buster Posey or whoever else. And so does it make sense to pair him with a guy who, I mean, it's a completely different skill set, but still someone who returns major league value in hedges a bit more often and keeps Mejia's bat fresh, even if it's not in the lineup.
Yeah. So, and the other thing about this deal for the Padres that makes it so interesting to me is that with Mejia in the fold now I think you can start to squint and look down the line. And, you know, the Padres were a very highly ranked, I think they were the top ranked system in BP's org rankings this year. Mm-hmm. But they also now have the kind of collection of top tier talent positionally, yeah, where you can squint and you look down the road and you see Urias, Fernando Tatis Jr., and Mejia all together now. And
plus Mackenzie Gore.
Oh, well, I'm not even getting into the pitching now.
Not even the pitching.
Okay. Yeah, because Gore is a mother. And I think they've got some really cool and interesting pitching arms. But we've seen how well that's worked out for the Padres in the past. But now you can see that positional core that's on its way up and say, okay, maybe we've got a team that in 2019 and 2020 can be the Braves of this year. And that's where you really want to be, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's tough because of the division that they're in. I think obviously the Dodgers are there, and the Diamondbacks, I think, get a little bit underrated. I think people see them as not quite as real as they should be because there's a behemoth there. Obviously, the Phillies and Braves had the Nationals to contend with, but they're not quite in the same position financially as the Dodgers are, or depth-wise. And obviously, mm-hmm, that's kind of played itself out this year.
Right.
But I think the Diamondbacks are a good team for the next 2 or 3 years at least. And the Rockies have a bunch of emergent talent. Their rotation has been better than it had any rights to be, kind of, you know, if you think about it that way. I mean, I think it's a... I don't think they can go quite from where Atlanta did to where Atlanta is now, or even Philly. But like you said, you can at least see the outline of it.
Right. And I think for them to get to where Atlanta is, they have to do the same thing that Atlanta did, which is finally have some of their young pitchers work out. And Atlanta would not be where they are today without Sean Newcomb and Mike Foltynewicz finally turning into, you know, at least.
And that's a time at the major league level for both of them.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Which is important. Those guys didn't come in and work out immediately. I mean, the other thing with Atlanta, I mean, they've just spent so much time and effort in acquiring arms. You know, a lot of people expected Luis Gohara to be a big part of their rotation this year. He hasn't even been there. So they had enough volume to handle that attrition.
And quite honestly, I've been really critical of Atlanta's path to rebuilding in the past. Their focus on getting all of these arms. And I've been very, very down on it for years because I don't trust these guys that they'd brought in. And for the most part, a lot of them haven't worked out. You know, they've traded for a bunch of Padres pitchers who haven't worked out and wouldn't have worked out for the Padres either. But they do, like you said, they got enough of them that they've been able to cycle through and find one or two of them that have really worked out, Newcomb and Foltynewicz. And then now they're starting to bring up the guys that they drafted, the Mike Soroka.
Or signed internationally, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I, you know, it's hard to give the Braves a lot of credit for their work internationally, given what we know
Acuña and Albies. I mean, and part of their resurgence is Albies being. I mean, and again, I've admitted multiple times on multiple platforms that I that was a miss on him. But I think even the people that liked him never saw 20 home runs at the break.
No. Nobody, I think, saw that coming. And I also think that nobody saw Johan Camargo coming. So there's been a lot of things that have worked out much to the Braves' benefit, in addition to their, you know, oh yeah, well, we expect Acuna to be able to be a solid major league regular from the jump. And yeah, Ender Inciarte, we've been talking for a long time about him being a very valuable cog and things like that. Freddie Freeman, probably more quietly than probably just about anybody else, yeah, being an MVP candidate.
And I would also, I just need to point out on Camargo, I saw him in high A. There are witnesses to this. I saw him in high A, and multiple people there that I talked to thought this is a future major leaguer. I still outperforming, you know, you're probably talking about a backup because no one really thought the bat was that good, but he was a good fielder. This again just goes to the point that the Braves' depth is insane, and that's why it's a good reference that you made to the Padres, because the depth of player that they have all the way through the system, some of them are going to go wrong, but they're going to get some guys like Camargo who are just down in the system, who people aren't even talking about that much, who are going to turn into useful major league pieces.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. So let's take this back for a second to the Indians, because one of the things you and I were talking about before we started recording was that with Mejia moving off this team and Bradley Zimmer not really working out the way that people had expected, it does kind of feel like the Indians are shortening their window of contention, perhaps at the expense of, in an attempt to widen the window that we have right now, get further in the playoffs, win a World Series, as opposed to just go out there and lose to the Cubs in seven, or make it back into the World Series, which they were unable to do last year. I respect that path. I think that's a really good decision for this team. They do most of their super tandem of Lindor and Ramirez players are starting to get into that kind of peak to post-peak phase of their careers. So I understand them wanting to power through right now and then hope that, you know, after some of these guys start to get on the downswing of their careers, that, you know, the strength of, well, we have Jose Ramirez and Francisco Lindor can carry them through the tougher times. But I do think that maybe we're starting to see this team finally as a team that may not just dominate the AL Central for every year in the foreseeable future. It may start to have a come down after, perhaps it's next year, perhaps it's the year after that.
Yeah, I do think this is, it's, I mean, again, we've talked about applauding them for going for it. I don't think this is a half measure, but there's one aspect in which it is. And that's, look, obviously these guys are signed for multiple years beyond this, but, and Simber is going to be very cheap because he had very little service time in general. Hand had the extension. It's cheap for the quality that you're getting. And they're addressing an issue that could have been an issue, you know, this free agency with Miller becoming a free agent. And I believe Allen is a free agent as well. They were going to have to spend to sign either one of those guys. I don't think they were going to spend to sign both. Mm-hmm. But I also think that this is kind of more where they shortened their window of contention. So despite getting years of service on Hand and Simber, those are just relievers, and that they shortened their contention in this way because Mejia was a potential star. And there's a lot of risk in that. There's a lot of variance in that. But when you look at their lineup and their team, you know, Michael Brantley's on the wrong side of 30, has injury issues. He's been great for them, but health concerns abound. And frankly, maybe you know, I don't know when he's signed through. Edwin Encarnacion is not signed for more than a couple more years. If it's beyond next year, Jason Kipnis has really been on the downswing. Yan Gomes has been better, but not great. You know, it's fine for a catcher, but he's been better than he has been, but not exactly a foundational piece. And then you're talking about, you know, Tyler Naquin, Greg Allen, Brandon Guyer. Like, I'm eliding the rotation,
right,
which is going to be very good. But also, one of those guys hurts himself, and, you know, where is the depth in Cleveland, which previously they've had a bunch of, seems to be thinning out a little bit. And, you know, when you talk about a star-driven team with a really good rotation, we need only look at the Mets to see how wrong that can go.
And very, very quickly. And yeah. I think that you make a great point with the aging out. Brantley will be a free agent at the end of the season. Encarnacion will be a free agent at the end of 2019, but I do think he has a team option.
Okay.
And so everything that you say is correct. Now, you're right. You're kind of passing over the rotation. The rotation is incredible.
It's incredible. It's and under I don't need control. To do that. They're insanely good.
Yeah, you've got Shane Bieber. You've got I'm sorry, who is it? Tristan McKenzie coming up.
Tristan McKenzie, right. He's at Double A already.
And you know, but on the positional side, it's like you got Yu Chang Chang and you've got Bobby Bradley as the only kind of like impactful guys who are near to the majors. So they're going to have to continue to make moves in order to bring in positional talent to replace some of these guys on the way out. That's and right. They're the Indians, and so they can't.
They don't always spend to do that.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's where I see the window shrinking a little bit. It doesn't mean it's gone. It's just not as long as it was. Because the idea, at least in my mind, was Mejia for 6 years, if he pans out, kind of makes up for a lot of other areas because he's both cheap and a high quality, high end production.
Yep. Well,
but the flip side of this is that they could deal these two relievers 2 years into this and get a bevy of prospects back.
Well,
right? I mean, there's more than just contend or not.
That could be true. I'm always nervous that, Brad Hand and Adam Simber are great today. Will they be great tomorrow? Mm-hmm. And you'll always have to worry about that with relievers. I have one last thing I want to ask you before we have to let you go. So we've got the Orioles, the Indians, the Padres, and the Dodgers. Which team did you like their move the best for? If you had to raise your hand and say, okay, this team did the best out of these four, which team would you point towards?
I think I like the Padres the most.
I think I'm kind of with you on that. I love the Machado deal for the Dodgers.
As do I. And I want to emphasize something that we talked about in the beginning. I think these are both pretty fair deals.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. I'm not sure I would have made them from different perspectives,
but
you can definitely see why, and you can definitely see, like, from a process perspective, there's nothing out here that jumps out as a red flag, I don't think.
I think that's a great way to put it.
Well, Craig, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I know that you have some stuff at BP you probably like to plug, where you do some phenomenal work with Jeff and the rest of the minor league staff there. Just give us 30 seconds on what you like best about what's going on at BP right now.
Sure. Well, we just did the midseason top 50 less than a week ago. It came out on the 13th of July. It's a little bit obviated with some of these guys trading teams, but the rankings are for the most part in the same order. And we did a bunch of risers and fallers for people who are interested in guys beyond the top 50 or in a lot of cases beyond what a top 100 would be, just guys who kind of changed their value in our minds. It's I guess a little bit of a stopwatch type thing. We also did a just missed around that. And then we're going to be contributing to what you guys do. Wilson Karaman did a great job on the Machado transaction analysis. And every week we have a Monday morning 10 pack. We have notes from the field. We just today did an eyewitness report that involved Kybert Ruiz and Mackenzie Gore. So not guys that were traded, but definitely guys that are talked about a bunch. We're doing stuff all the time and hopefully people will check it out.
Yeah, it's well worth your time. And I second what Wilson wrote in his TA and what I've seen from Jeff Paternoster is going to be writing up Mejia for Aaron Gleeman's TA that he's doing. It's always excellent work and your editing is just makes it even better than it already was. So thank you so much for joining. We're going to cut it short and we're going to let you go, but thank you very much for listening. You can always find out more about the DFA podcast at DFA podcast on Twitter, or just find us at Baseball Prospectus. Thanks a lot. And we'll see you guys next time.